meeting. We'll call this meeting of the special committee, House Special Committee on Fisheries to order at 10:15 a.m. Today is Tuesday, April 6, 2021. Members present at this time, Representative McCabe, Representative Story, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Ortiz, Speaker Stutes, and myself, Representative Tarr. Yes. Oh, and there is Representative Vance. Perfect. Welcome. Please let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. We would ask members to please silence their cell phones as we get started. Ask you to pass notes using the committee aide, Thatcher Brower. A special thank you to Shannon McCain, our committee secretary, and Tom Raymond from the Juno LIO for their support. As a reminder, the recording secretary is still working remotely, and so I think we probably do this about 50% of the time, myself included, but we're trying to identify ourselves for the record before we speak, and so keep trying to do that. We have a couple agenda items today: House Bill 54, Invasive Species Management, and then House Bill 82, Gas Leases Renewable Energy Grant Fund from the governor. We're going to start with House Bill 54. We've already had a couple of hearings and taken public testimony, and we've been working on this as a committee bill, and so we have wanted to try to address, you know, any concerns that folks had. We have Commissioner Vincent Lang, I believe. Well, I'm not seeing him just yet, but he's supposed to be. Oh, he is there. Okay, he's on Teams. There we go. So he's available for questions. But the one issue that had come up is that we didn't want to have the $60,000 that was necessary to fund the council be from UGF, Unrestricted General Fund, at this time. And so we talked about a couple of different ideas of how to address that. And you do have an amendment laying on the table here, and this, I hope, is acceptable because it came after the deadline as we continue to work with everyone to address the issues. But if I could just summarize, well, and perhaps actually we could start, if it would be okay to start with a motion.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to do that. I move Amendment 1 to House Bill 54, labeled 32-LS 0057/W.1.
I'll object for discussion. And this amendment is legislative intent language. It's the intent of the legislature. The Department of Fish and Game supports the activities of the Alaska Invasive Species Council established by this act through contributions, grants, and other forms of funding that do not involve the use of money from the state's general fund. That there were basically two options suggested. One was sort of adjusting the fiscal note, and we were told, you know, that's not really something we should be doing in the Fisheries Committee. That could be potentially addressed in the Finance Committee. But then also there was a sort of this concern of preventing the commissioner from being able to move forward with seeking the grant funds. And so this seemed like perhaps the better option, and we can establish through the discussion that it is the intent that this not be funded through UGF. And if people are comfortable with that, then we could use this option. This does have another committee referral to the Resources Committee. So then, you know, if we continue working and there seems like an even better option, we could, you know, I'm open to that. I want to, pardon me, as a committee bill, make sure that we're, you know, we have a piece of legislation everybody's comfortable with. So that is the explanation for today. And again, Commissioner Vincent Lang is available for any questions. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the event that Amendment 1 passes as becomes part of the bill, is there any assessment as to the likelihood of being able to fund this, you know, the activities of the Alaska Invasive Species Council, and to actually, I mean, it sounds good that we would have other funds other than GF, but what is there a sense of reality of that actually happening, is my question.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. And I'm going to answer, and then I'm going to ask the commissioner to answer, because we had a lot of conversations about this, and he felt comfortable. My takeaway was he felt comfortable that there were grant opportunities out there, and I am aware of grant opportunities out there for this kind of work, also some federal funding. And then we had that kind of serendipity happen with the hatchery bill, where we we kept $250 in the fee, and then through the amendment by Representative Vance, expanded that language to include invasive species management. So that would be another place. And so that could be, you know, through statutory designated receipts. But because that bill is still moving through the process, can't really get ahead of ourselves on that. So those are all the different options I think are out there that make me feel comfortable. But Commissioner, could you also please add in with your thoughts?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm convinced that there are pots of money out there that we could tap into to support this council. Remember, this bill had originally had regulatory authorities associated with it as well as the council, and I thought a first positive step would be to form the council to evaluate some of the issues associated with invasive species and come together with some solid recommendations that could move forward. Inside the department, we're looking at other funding sources, for instance, state wildlife action grants and the Fish and Game Fund, given the importance that invasive species play in the state and the threats that it poses to our existing fish and game resources. So I'm convinced through a variety of different sources that we could fund this council without necessarily having UGF to support its work over the first 2 or 3 years.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? I'll remove my objection. Is there any other objection to adopting amendment number one? Okay. Seeing no objection, amendment number one, that's 32-LS0057/W.1, has been adopted. That brings the bill back before us. Is there any additional discussion on House Bill 54? Okay. Oh, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just taking a look at my notes that from our last meeting, and I don't remember asking it, so just out of curiosity, you know, we've been focusing on the invasive species regarding the marine industry that's obviously near and dear to our hearts, and specifically this committee, but will this council also be looking at invasive birds that and other animals that could be affecting our state?
Thank you. And if you look through the, let me just look here at the bill and look at the membership and then the tasks, there's definitely the intention with Department of Natural Resources and then also Department of Fish and Game both being participants in the council that it would be aquatic and terrestrial and could be both vegetative and other living organisms. So I think the point will be for them to have that comprehensive overview and plan.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay. Well, if there's no further discussion, I do want to just say, as a committee bill, we'll absolutely be working with everyone as this goes to the next committee of referral, and really appreciate getting to work with everyone on this because it's just kind of impacting all of us in different ways throughout the state. And so hopefully, if we can get this through, it's something that will be beneficial, you know, for all of Alaska. So that feels good. So thank you so much. Madam Speaker, I would entertain a motion.
My pleasure, Madam Chair. I move to report House Bill 54, Invasive Species Management, version 32-LS0057/W, from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, thank you. We will circulate the paperwork for that. And because we started a couple minutes late, and I know other, folks might have other things in their schedule, I think we'll just transition into our second item, and that is House Bill 82. House Bill 82 has been introduced by the governor, and I believe we have several members from the DNR team here to present House Bill 82. I have Haley Payne, Deputy Director, Division of Oil and Gas, and then that's for presenting the bill. And then Sean Clifton, program and policy specialist from the Department of Natural Resources, for questions. So I see both of those folks online right now. And so if you want to go ahead and get started, welcome.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, and good morning to the committee. We thank you for your time and the opportunity to present today. So as stated for the record, my name is Haley Payne, and I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. With me today is Sean Clifton. He is our Program and Policy Specialist. Today we'll be presenting on House Bill 82 on gas leases and the Renewable Energy Grant Fund. For our presentation today, we will start with a general overview, which includes the purpose of this bill, and then we'll move into a more detailed sectional analysis. So with that, we'll advance to slide 2 to address the purpose. So the main purpose of this bill is to allow the Division of Oil and Gas to lease and capture revenue from state-owned resources that are underlying lands restricted to surface use. What's important to note is this bill does not open Ketchikan Bay or any other closed area to surface development. It aims only to capture royalty revenue from geology drained through adjacent development on nearby unrestricted lands. With modern drilling technologies, oil and gas may be safely developed from adjacent lands with no impact to the surface of restricted areas, and this includes offshore. In relation to this bill and the subject matter area that will be discussed on slide 4, this means that the non-surface leasing will not threaten the fisheries of Ketchikan Bay. The primary benefit of this bill would be increased revenue. Lands with surface use restrictions can still provide revenue in the form of lease sale bids, annual rental payments, and royalties if made available for subsurface-only development. The state will be able to protect the lands using established regulatory methods while still maximizing the economic recovery of its resources. We can move on to slide 3 unless there are any questions.
Any questions?
I'll wait.
Okay. Slide 3. Is that? I think we're going to advance one more. Okay.
Thank you. So here on slide 3, we have what happens if we cannot lease. So the main concern is the mechanism for collecting royalties. If the unleased land is drained from wells on adjacent leases, royalties may not be paid to that state, to the state, or that revenue could be diminished. For instance, the wellhead may be located on private lands, and this may prevent the state from realizing the revenue unless remedy is sought through AOGCC and a correlative rights claim. Moreover, leasing is the standard mechanism for establishing a contractual relationship between the state and the developer. Through the lease, the state exercises its authority to comply with mitigation measures and to require the sharing of drilling and reservoir data. This is data that is integral to the state for understanding the extent of our resources. We can move to slide 4 unless there are any questions.
Any questions? Okay, please continue.
Thank you. So slide 4 is going to depict the subject area discussed in section 2 of the bill. The bill seeks to allow gas-only leasing of the subject area while maintaining the surface use restrictions that are currently in place. The offshore lands in the Township 5 South, Range 15 West are shown within the context of the Greater Cook Inlet area-wide on the right, and in more detail in the close-up image on the left. There is a blue hatching area that specifically shows the township in question. So as you can see from this map, the subject area is adjacent to active development on the Kenai Peninsula. This includes the Seaview unit, which was recently approved by the division in October of 2020. I'd also like to draw your attention to the Cosmopolitan unit, which is just to the north there, those olive-colored leases. That is an offshore lease area that is currently being developed from the onshore Hansen pad, which is located on private lands. It's about halfway up the unit along the coastline. So this is an example that shows the successful access of offshore resources without impacting the surface use of these waters. As a further note on our map here, the green hatched outline, that is the extent of our current Cook Inlet area-wide sail boundary. And you can see the red line showing the Ketchumak Bay oil and gas closure area. We're ready to move to the next slide. On slide 5, we can go into the sectional analysis. So in section 1 of the bill, we add a new section to AS 3805, specifying a statute that restricts the surface use of an oil and gas or gas-only lease, does not also restrict leasing and development at the subsurface of that area from unrestricted land. This is a general provision. It is intended to broadly capture the purpose of this bill and address future surface use restrictions that may be imposed on the state's natural resources. So following this more general provision on the next slide, slide 6, we go into sections 2 and 3. And so here we have specifically where AS 3804-184 would be amended to authorize DNR to offer gas-only leases in the area within that specific township, as depicted on the map previously shown on slide 4. Again, there would be no right to use the surface of the land. This would be keeping with the original intention of the Ketchumak Bay oil and gas closure area to protect the region's fisheries. In B of the statute is amended to acknowledge the exemption that is now created with the new subsection in H. Moving on to slide 7, we detail sections 4 through 6 of the bill. So recognizing the unique nature of this area to be leased here, AS 4245-045B is amended to allow the legislature to appropriate revenue from these specific leases to the Renewable Energy Grant Fund. The governor recognized in this bill an opportunity to add funds to this account as a part of the all-of-the-above energy approach sources for Alaska. Revenue would come from the state's rentals and royalties collected through these specific leases. Such appropriations would occur after the required deposits to the Alaska Permanent Fund that are required in the Alaska Constitution, and all appropriations would, of course, be at the discretion of the legislature. The final sections of the bill provide a bit of housekeeping, moves language about the department revenue of the manager of the fund, and provides for the bill to be effective immediately. And with that, we are at the conclusion of our short presentation here on the bill and look forward to answering any questions and providing more background or information as needed to understand it.
Thank you. And I think we have some questions. Speaker Stutes and then Representative Vance, I think, had a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciated the opportunity yesterday to get a little bit of heads up on this because it helped me understand it a little more. And I think that it's important that it be made clear to this committee that this development could conceivably take place without this lease. It's just that the state wouldn't receive any revenue for it. Was I correct in understanding that?
Speaker Stutes, through the chair, yes, you are absolutely correct. As we discussed yesterday, there is the potential that given the current development that is happening or planned to occur there from onshore, the way the subsurface geology works is the reservoir itself may, in fact, be drained by current we planned vertical wells. So even without attempting to go through to the subsurface of the lands underlying the water, the pressures from the permitted development of unrestricted lands could allow the gas molecules to go ahead and migrate their way over. However, at that point in time, it wouldn't be considered from a state lands lease, and so we would be losing that revenue or have that revenue diminished. And as brought up earlier in the presentation, there could be a remedy through AOGCC, but it would involve a more lengthy discussion, and as well, some of the more immediate revenues from rentals and lease sale bids would not be realized.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a list of questions, and know that a change like this is definitely going to get attention in my community. And I have several questions, but one of the first questions, just in talking about the possible loss of revenue for the state, is there an estimate on how much revenue could be had if this bill were to pass?
So, Representative Vance, to the chair, while we do not have an exact figure at this time, the particular unit and area around there is still being delineated, and so it would be a little premature for us to try to estimate an exact value. At this time, there is only one well that is looking to come online as soon as a pipeline is built there onshore to connect to the existing onshore infrastructure. So I do not have a specific funding target for you at this time, Representative.
Okay.
Continue.
Thank you for that. I know that, and I knew that you wouldn't have anything estimate, but just for the project, you know, they have an idea that they hope that is obviously going to be profitable. And as soon as you know, it would be helpful for me to know what that figure could be. Because from the perspective of my district, I think this would be a heavy lift for any changes, because the proposed area is a critical habitat area. And so just for sake of conversation, can you speak to just the history of oil and gas in Kachemak Bay and how subsurface drilling is so much safer than, for instance, an oil rig?
Yes. So for the record, this is Sean Clifton. Through the chair, Representative Vance. So this Kachemak Bay oil and gas closure area was conceived back in the mid-70s after the George Ferris rig got stuck in the mud out there. And I'm sure that your constituents probably have that in their minds. And, there was lease buybacks that were a part of that the legislature approved, and then of course this statute here 3805-184 was enacted after that to explicitly protect this habitat. And we just want to make very clear that nothing about this bill proposal would change that. We are in fact honoring that explicit desire to protect the habitat, and we're preserving that by not allowing any surface impact. And the surface, if it's not clear, it does include the water. And so, from the water all the way down to the sea floor, there would be no drilling offshore, no pipelines, no platforms, no jackup rigs to get stuck in the mud or mess with the crab fishery. So this is fully honoring that. This is only opening up that offshore acreage so that we can lease it, which is our usual contractual relationship with developers, so that they can access, from offshore, and so that we can then get our royalty revenue from that. Does that answer your question satisfactorily?
Yes. Yes, because that is, the George Ferris incident is very ripe in people's minds when it comes to this, and very protective of our bay. And so is there an opportunity that a spill or a leak could ever happen, and what would the response be?
Representative Vance, I'll answer that through the chair. Thank you. And so as Sean had articulated there, there would not be any, you know, well casings placed within this area whatsoever. So everything would only happen either from the shore itself, and so there would be no pipelines, there would be no infrastructure. There would be nothing that could come to leak, as it were, and pollute the waters there. Furthermore, there are extensive regulatory prevention and protection laws in place through the state, the federal government, extensive plans that I'd be happy to send in more detail over to your office for review about how we work with our hydrocarbon developers throughout the state to ensure safety. And these measures are well documented throughout Cook Inlet. As you are aware, we have several areas. You know, Cook Inlet is the home of oil and gas development in our state, and it has been a successful avenue here for us since the early 60s. We do even have several examples within the current Cook Inlet sale area where we are currently in development using critical habitat areas. So, for example, there's the Redoubt Bay critical habitat area, Calgen Island critical habitat area, Clam Gulch critical habitat area, Trading Bay State Game Refuge. And so we are very much minded and aware of the protections that need to take place in order to honor these critical habitat areas. And it is quite common throughout Cook Inlet development to prevent surface use in certain areas and to ensure the ongoing protections of the fisheries and the wildlife uses that they need.
Well, sure. Thank you for that. You answered my last question, and that was, are there other critical habitat areas with projects like this? And you listed quite a few that I am familiar with. So I don't have any other questions at this point.
Okay, thank you so much, Representative Vance. And since it is your backyard, I hope that you'll be able to get all your questions answered. Representative Ortiz and then McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And kind of a follow-up on Representative Vance's question. And it's, why are we seeing this particular bill now? What is it that's changed in, if you can explain it more in layman's terms, what's changed in technology that would allow an onshore developer to be able to access, I think you used the words gas something. How is it that, yeah, I guess, why are we seeing this bill now? What is this, what has changed that would allow an onshore developer to gain access to these resources under the subsurface of Ketchikan Bay? How about that?
Well, so part of what has changed, for the record, this is Sean Clifton through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Part of what has changed is that this area at the southern end of our sale area has recently seen a lot of new lease activity, almost exclusively from Hillcorp. And not only have they been acquiring leases from us, but they've also been acquiring leases from local private resource owners. And the Kenai Peninsula is unique in having a lot of homesteaded land that was patented before at statehood to include the mineral estate, whereas most land that was acquired afterwards, the state retained the mineral estate. And so we've seen a lot of new lease activity in this area as Hillcorp has been looking for new places to develop gas in order to keep our homes warm and the electricity running. And so the other aspect of newer technologies is the ability to drill deeper or longer lateral wells, and also the advancement of fracking technologies. You know, fracking itself is not new. It's been around for more than a century, but the newer technologies that make it more effective basically allow a single well to get access to more gas migrating to it than may have been possible in the 70s. And so this is a new opportunity for us to get access to gas from onshore that may have been less likely 50 years ago.
appreciate that answer. And again, keep in mind you're speaking very much to a layman, someone that doesn't have a lot of knowledge on how this actually works. But without, you said that if such development were to happen, it wouldn't include any pipeline, any infrastructure per se. So how is it that these natural gas elements get transferred to the land without any pipeline or any infrastructure? How does that happen? I just don't understand that.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, basically, if you could think of the rock like a sponge, you know, it's solid, but there is pore space where the molecules can still move through it. And so gas will migrate through the rock, through the pore space in that rock, to the well. And with what fracking does is it opens up more of that pore space and holds it open farther from where the well is drilled. And so you can have gas migrating quite a long ways to that well bore, so that, and you know, and of course you also have the differential pressure that helps it move to the well and then up through the wellhead on the surface. And so that is how you can have development from, you know, a mile or two or four offshore that doesn't actually involve drilling a well or establishing a pipeline offshore in the water at all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCabe, and then Speaker Stutes.
Thank you for that. So, and through the chair, I'm interested, maybe a little bit of layman's description of how directional drilling works, such as how far inshore will the drill rig be, where is the mud storage, how deep is the well before the blocker is set and it goes underneath the shoreline into sort of the water, and how deep are we talking about for this field? Are we 10,000 feet, 20,000 feet? Are we setting the blocker under the shoreline at 10,000 feet? So I'm kind of interested to know how that is working for this field.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, I don't know the specific depth of this the pool that is proposed to be developed in the CVU unit. I could refer to our published decision establishing the participating area and get those details to your office later today. But I could say generally, wells can be miles deep, and miles long. The development just to the north, the cosmopolitan unit on the map that we referred to earlier in the presentation, those wells are all developed from an onshore pad and reach out as far as 4 miles offshore. And you know, the way that they access that is they have developed drilling technology for steering the well with quite a degree of control and accuracy through the strata so that they can reach very specific targets.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. So I appreciate, and through the chair, I'm maybe, you know, since this is a fisheries committee, and of course everybody's concerned about the fisheries, which is sort of why we're here, it would be important to know, I think, how deep we're going to be as we go through the under the shoreline, and also is there any possibility that the drilling mud, which is a problem in most drill operations, the disposal and the cleanup and leakage and all that sort of stuff. So we're particularly interested in those things, I think, that could affect the fishery. And if you could tell, or if there's a way to tell demarcation where the shoreline is and how deep the bit or the hole will be as it crosses into our pristine Kachemak Bay waters, that would be, I think, helpful in explaining this to concerned citizens. So anything that you can give us that would sort of show the mechanics of it would be really great, I would think.
If I may, through the chair, Representative McCabe, I would say, be able to say now that the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the AOGCC, does extensive review of the engineering plans for each well that they permit. And so one of their main jobs is to protect the environment and especially protect like drinking water aquifers and water that we rely on for fisheries and things like that. And so if they would never permit a well to be drilled if there appeared to be any threat to either our drinking water aquifers onshore or our fishery waters offshore.
And just to add on to that, pardon me, just to add an addition, what we can also supply yourself and other members of the committee with is, you know, while the area in question, the specific township, we don't have a specific project in front of us that's saying this is how we're going to develop this. So I wouldn't be able to present you those sort of project specifications or numbers. But what we can get to you is information about the currently approved participating area onshore at the Seaview unit. Which would have more information, including, you know, the depth of the reservoir that they're targeting there. And we could also share, as another example, the information from the Cosmopolitan Unit, which is just to the north. The Cosmopolitan Unit would be different. It is accessing oil. And what we're proposing here is gas only. And so, again, you know, one of the main points in terms of the original closure of the act was specific to oil. And so that's yet another reason we're going for gas only and non-surface access for this leasing area. But we'd be happy to share those two examples to see if there's any sort of correlative information that may be able to provide you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Speaker Stutes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So I was, an alarm went off when I heard the term, when I heard you use the term fracking. Because I know that that's a very controversial process, and I'm, as Representative Ortiz, I'm a layman in this kind of information. But so this is actually a fracking process. And if it is there much of that going on in Alaska currently? And I guess, like I said, that sends up some concerns for me at this point.
Okay. Through the chair, Speaker Stutes. Fracking is very common. It's, you know, almost all oil or gas wells are fracked because it improves the performance of the well. It is not a new phenomenon. You can look back into the oldest wells drilled in the state or in well records in the country. It's been around for more than a century. And, you know, the only reason why it has become a new hot button topic is because it is the technology around fracking has improved, and it has allowed the development of things like shale oil that were previously not able to be developed without those new technologies. But fracking itself is very common. It's very safe. And again, as with all other aspects of well permitting, that stuff is available through the AOGCC. They take a very hard look at it, and everything from the engineering of the well design to the, you know, what they're going to do with the fluids as far as disposal once the job is finished. That is all very it's a very detailed process in the way that they look at it. They have very sharp and experienced engineers that look at it. And so I don't think that there is any reason to see it as unsafe or any kind of a special threat to the fishery.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Well, it can't be all that safe because I know that there are at least one state, if I'm not mistaken, and it wouldn't be the first time I've made a mistake, but that has outlawed fracking. Am I wrong in that?
Through the chair, Speaker Stutes, yes, I do believe that I heard something about one or maybe even more state legislatures proposing to ban fracking in their states. I would say first that doesn't mean that from a scientific or engineering perspective there was any good reason for them to ban it. Most of the information that goes, you know, like the activist information that is spread about fracking is misinformation, is not based in science. If they were a genuine threat, are the very smart folks over at the AOGCC would not be allowing it to go on. But they do, and that information is freely available to the public every time that they permit fracking.
And again, Speaker Stutes, we can, in the information that we provide regarding some of these other nearby developments, you can see how this hydraulic fracking is already occurring very close by and is permitted within the Cook Inlet Sale area. So you can see the track record just based on the years of operation of all of the nearby fields. And so hopefully that can help provide a little bit of assurance that this is a very well as Sean mentioned, regulated and researched avenue. So we would not be proposing anything here that is not already widely used throughout the state. This isn't trying to use some experimental technology or experimental methodology, of course, in this area. And again, everything would be happening at the way subsurface depths. So we're, you know, talking at least 6,000 feet below the surface or the, you know, the water line underneath, I should say.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have Representative Story, then McCabe, then Ortiz.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. This is Representative Story for the record. You've told us the benefits of adding this project to Catchmac Bay, meaning revenue and access to more gas. I'm sure you've assessed consequences of not doing this or negative consequences, and it'd be nice to have that assessment, what you can provide when you looked at this project, what you felt were cons about recommending this, as well as the pros. That would be helpful to me.
So Representative Story through the chair. So as we were explaining earlier on, the con for us for not moving forward with this particular bill is going to be the lost revenue to the state. It's going to be that these hydrocarbon resources could be inefficiently developed unwittingly just by the differentials and pressures that are there present in the geology, and that the state would thereby lose its potential revenue from it. So that is at this point in time, our large con. We don't see any environmental or other sort of concern in terms of the weighing of the benefits and the risks in terms of this. And as you will see, I'll reference some documents in the email that we send out in our Cook Inlet Best Interest Finding, the one that we do for our entire sale area. We take a hard look at everything from the fish, wildlife, habitat, the communities, and really evaluate everything as a holistic picture when it comes to oil and gas development and the benefits to the state. So that may be able to, on a broad scale, kind of answer that question. But as we said, most specifically for this discrete township, what we see as the greatest con is just the lost potential revenue that can occur. So, for instance, as we will see in the information we send you, the current Clark participating area, which is the approved development area for the Seaview unit, is currently at a 60-40 split, which means it's 60% held by private mineral owners and 40% by the state. And so any hydrocarbons that come to the surface there are going to be split up the revenues there based on certain track factors along with that mineral ownership. And so at this point in time, if those offshore areas that are currently proposed as a part of this could be drained in some way, the state would not have its proper revenue share because it would be splitting it amongst these other parties. And so if we are able to formally lease and capture and quantify, you know, what the reservoir target is, which that reservoir data is something that only becomes available to us through the formal lease contract, then we can justify and reallocate those tracked factor percentages to further allow for the state to realize its true potential, which I don't have any specific numbers, as I alerted Representative Vance to before, but, you know, it could definitely sway it far from a 60-40 to, you know, perhaps 75-25, just as a number to throw out in favor of this state. So for us, that is really where we see the potential con on this bill. And again, for oil and gas development in the state in general, it's something that we rigorously look at in our best interest finding for the entire sale area of Cook Inlet.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, through the chair. My follow-up would be, this is Rep. Story, that if any of those assessments that you did on fish, wildlife, and community would be helpful when you were looking at this project. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Next is Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and through the chair, I'm hearing you say that there are private subsurface, private land where the subsurface rights are owned because it was pre-statehood or pre-charter, and that people are already considering or are already drilling on there, and they can possibly suck the gas out of this field, leaving Alaska, leaving the state with nothing. I think that's what I'm hearing you say. And my second follow-up question would be fracking. So I'm a little bit familiar with fracking. It's hydraulic, I think. It's done with millions of gallons of water, which I believe is why some states have prohibited it, or a state has prohibited it, because to get those millions of gallons of water, you have to go into the local aquifer and pull water out of there, if I'm not mistaken, and then you inject it down the hole, and the hydraulic pressure sort of expands the rock and creates little fissures that the gas can come through. Maybe you could correct me if that's wrong, but that's where it's not that the fracking causes the aquifer to go away. It's that the fracking process, if I'm not mistaken, takes water out of the aquifer, which affects the local wells. So maybe you could just correct me if my understanding is wrong on that.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe. So as far as the fracking goes, I don't think anywhere in the country, you know, but most certainly not the state, would any drilling company be allowed to inject waste fluids into an aquifer. That is certainly not the case here. You know, we're also talking about you know, drilling operations, whether the development wells or the waste disposal wells are thousands of feet deep, you know, it's often miles deep, whereas our drinking water aquifers are usually 100 feet deep, maybe 400 feet deep in some cases. You know, you're talking about a difference of thousands of miles of depth. And furthermore, you know, the AOGCC, when they permit a waste disposal well, they look at the possibility of those waste fluids, where they're injected, of migrating into a place where they can contaminate either aquifers or surface waters. And they would never permit a waste disposal well that had any risk to that. And so, you know, that is a concern that I have certainly heard before in you know, the fracking debates, is that there might be some risk to drinking water aquifers, but you know, waste disposal wells are much, much deeper than aquifers are. Waste is never injected into an aquifer that people drink out of, or that is used to irrigate crops. And so, as for the other question that you had asked, as far as private owners developing, in the first case, so private landowners typically can't afford the millions of dollars required to permit and drill a well and establish a pad and all of the infrastructure required to to produce gas, let alone build a pipeline extension so that they can bring it to some kind of a market. And so the private mineral owners themselves are not drilling wells and developing any of this stuff. What many of the private mineral owners in this area have done is signed a lease agreement with PillCorp, and then for the case of those leases that are within the Seaview unit area, they are working interest owners, just like the state is within that unit, and then share in the value of production and for their royalties.
Thank you.
And so there's not a lot of independent drilling going on.
So follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So by private landowner, I get that Hillcorp's doing it, but the private landowner will be getting the royalties, not the state in this case, right? Because you mentioned that there are some pre-statehood lands that have subsurface rights. So if they do lease their land to Hillcorp, then Hillcorp doesn't have to pay the state anything. They just pay the private owner, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Royalties. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, the way that that royalties are dispersed is so in the lease agreement, we have a royalty rate. In most cases in the Cook Inlet, it's 12.5%. And it's allocated by parcel or by lease. And there's also some engineering involved to figure out what percentage of each parcel is contributing to gas to the producing well. And so based on that calculation of the percentage that is contributing and the royalty rate, that determines how much of the value of that produced gas goes to each mineral owner. And so we can when we follow up with you, I will show you the schedule by which that has already been figured out for the Clark participating area in Seaview.
One more follow-up, if you'll indulge me. Thank you, Madam Chair. My point, I think, is that 12%, 12.5%, does not go to the state. It goes to the private landowner if that private landowner has the subsurface rights, correct?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, yes, that is correct. We, as in the state of Alaska, does not receive any revenue from private mineral interests lands.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions here, if we've gotten through everyone's. So there's a question about, and I just want to give you the opportunity to clarify this, about the type of drilling. And so you have indicated this would be from vertical wells. And if you look on page one in the section one that's added, it says, for starting on line eight there, lease or a gas-only lease in specified acreage does not also restrict subsurface use for oil and gas resource development that can be accomplished by drilling from acreage that does not have surface use restrictions. So, you're talking about the vertical wells, but would this also enable then directional drilling of any kind just to think about the overall sort of impact from the other wells?
Yes, Chair Tarr, this is Haley Payne again. So I would say that, yes, the general nature of this provision does contemplate that any sort of well, be it vertical or perhaps horizontal, that is able to access the subsurface of a restricted land from an unrestricted land would be permitted. So you are correct that in this particular township that we are discussing here, it is thought through vertical. However, a lateral well is also possible, as is the case. This is not talking about restricted areas, but as what's happening in Cosmopolitan Unit, that's where we see lateral wells that are accessing the subsurface.
Thank you. And I think that's possibly where there could be more concern in terms of kind of the overall impact, environmental impact in, for fisheries concern, for example. And I think one thing that I'm always looking to is, you know, how the local community is responding to a proposal. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to have any public meetings or have any local governments taken a position. The bill packet didn't have anything, so I wanted to ask what is happening there. And I think the concern is just, you know, if it's sort of like the first of something, then is this just the first time that we're going to consider this? And does this set a precedent? And if so, want to be thoughtful about what precedent that sets, you know, for future proposals.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So at this point in time, we have not had any public meetings to discuss the bill with the local communities. We do address the public through our sale area, the broader Cook Inlet sale area-wide, as a part of the best interest finding process. So anytime we go to dispose of the several million acres in the Cook Inlet, we engage with members of all the different communities, NGOs, local government organizations, we public notice, and we have a public comment period. So the sale area itself of the Greater Cook Inlet has had a very robust public comment period, as well as engagement of local communities, Native organizations. But this particular bill, we have not gone through and worked directly with those same public folks at this time. It is from a procedural point of view. So if this bill were to be passed, then we would need to expand the Cook Inlet area sale boundary to include this area. In order to do that, we would have to publish, we would have to call for new information and supplemental information from the public before we can change our sale area boundary. We did this just, I think, 2 years ago when we went to include the lands on the Inniskan Peninsula. And so as a part of that process, there would be a public notice process. There would be the opportunity to comment. We would have to review those comments and then provide responses and then make the decision about whether or not expanding the sale area is in the best interest of the state. So this portion here lays the legislative possibility for it, but there would still be a separate public process as a part of the sale area best interest finding that would then incorporate and alert the members of the public and allow them of their ability to participate.
Thank you. Representative Vance has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, your job is to look for the best interest of the state, but my job is to look after the best interest of my people. And you've mentioned that there are private land owners who are benefiting from the royalties and not the state at this time. On this proposed area, do you know how many homesteads there are or what the percentage, the ratio of the private versus public land?
Representative Vance to the chair. Yes, that will be as a part of that supplemental information that we give you. We have that in the Seaview unit decision as well as in the Clark participating area. That will go down into all of the individual names of the different parcels, the tract factors or royalty percentages that Representative McCabe had referenced before. And so that we'll be able to provide that to you in a detailed kind of map and exhibit format following this discussion.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of a statement, an observation. It feels like I am being asked to choose between providing a source of revenue for the people of my district and whom I know personally. They've homesteaded, they've helped build the community there, versus providing a source of revenue for the state. And that's setting aside all of the other concerns, you know, for the environment and the impact on the community. I mean, obviously, if you look at that map, and Anchor Point area is well-versed in the oil and gas. But when we are being asked to expand further south in the Kachemak Bay area and potentially transferring revenue from the people to the state, that gives me great heartburn. And so I will be asking a lot more questions for clarification and for the sake of the public so that this proposal is very, very clear on what's going to be involved so that we can make a more informed decision. Thank you, Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I respond to Representative Vansler, please?
Sure.
Just one note. So I think there may have been something that we did not communicate properly. So let's say this situation arises where these resources are drained, and as you articulated there, then the money would be going to private landowners instead of the state. What the state would do is petition the AOGCC for correlative rights. So we would actually still go through with the process that would attempt to demonstrate that our subsurface area is actually being drained. And then that money, instead of going directly to landowners, may be sitting in some pot at AOGCC until a case can be resolved that would be litigated and decide who ultimately has those resources. So just to kind of add that point to it, there is still a remedy through correlative rights and through AOGCC where the state would still pursue its own mineral interest to protect that. So I hope I articulated that a bit better this time. But we would also be out the revenue that would be realized from the rentals and as well from the bonus bids from leasing the tracks. So while we could hope to later at some point down the line after a correlative rights process seek to remedy some of the royalties, there would be other revenues that would just be left on the table and lost to the state.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would be helpful, I think, for us to understand how many people in this area would be affected. In other words, how many leases does Hillcorp have on lands where the subsurface rights belong to the private citizen? Is it one? Is it 10? How many parcels and how far along maybe are they? Have they completed a pad? Have they completed drilling? And, I think AOGCC would probably have that information, right, because it all has to be permitted through them. So that would be helpful to understand. And one more thing that came up that I wouldn't mind asking, could you tell us maybe what the difference is between vertical drilling and horizontal drilling? It's my understanding that all drills start horizontally and they don't go vertical until they get a certain number of feet underground. And it's not like they make a 90-degree turn necessarily. They're actually, once you get 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 feet underground, then you start steering the bit and it goes, that's when it gets into the into the gas reservoir, if I'm not mistaken. It's not, I don't think they just start out and go at an angle, right?
Yes, through the chair, Representative McCabe, yes, all the wells do start vertically. And, there's the way that wells are designed too, you also have series of progressively narrower and narrower casing in order to, that is designed to keep the well safe and stable. And then it's not until they get to their target depth that they start breaking out from that and steering towards their target or around other obstacles, whether it's other wells or an aquifer or whatever they need to avoid. They also do directional drilling in order to avoid hazards.
Thank you.
Okay. Couple things that have come up through this discussion, and we're going to hold this bill, and so I know you're going to be trying to get us some additional information, and so I just want to kind of do a little bit of housekeeping here. There was a question about revenue. We have a Department of Natural Resources fiscal note, but there's no Department of Revenue fiscal note. If one could be prepared, that would be helpful, because there are some questions about revenue. You said you have the Cook Inlet assessment data from the Cook Inlet best findings, best interest findings, so that could be shared. That would be helpful. And then Representative McCabe just had the question about how many leases are in, the private owner leases sort of ratio. And let me see if I have anything else here. I think that might be all of the notes I had kind of just jotted down there. So you did talk about the process with the AOGCC. I wonder if you could estimate a timeline on that, if you have any other representative examples of where the state tried to use that process.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are catching up our notes as well and making sure they align with all the requests there, and we will certainly follow up with all of those items. I did have another note to make sure that for the correlative examples that I think one of the, or two of these documents will answer multiple questions, specifically the CVU unit decision and the Clark participating area. That will also reference Representative McCabe's earlier questions in terms of trying to understand the depth of the potential reservoirs. It'll have information about the pad that has already been improved and built in the area. So we'll be able to provide all of that as well for you.
Excellent. That sounds really good. Thank you. Are there any other questions for the presenters at this time? Okay, we will go ahead and then into public testimony. We have Josh Wisniewski's, and pardon me if I am saying that incorrectly, from Soldovia.
Hi, it's Wisniewski, and that's no problem. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak today. Again, my name is Josh Wisniewski. I live in Soldovia. I first moved to Kachemak Bay in 1994 when I was 17. I'm a Kachemak Bay commercial fisherman. I set net at Barabra Point where I live and fish my halibut IFQ out of my skiff throughout the bay, in addition to participating in all of our state and federally managed subsistence fisheries here in the bay. I just adamantly oppose this bill or any form of oil and gas development here in Kachemak Bay that's surface or subsurface, and I think it's completely inconsistent with the purpose as well as the spirit of designating Kachemak Bay as a critical habitat area. Though it was briefly mentioned, for those totally uncertain with the history of the designation of Kachemak Bay as a critical habitat area, it was led by Republicans such as Clem Tillion as well as Governor Hammond to protect the ecological integrity of this area to support our area commercial fisheries. So I think proposing oil and gas development, surface or subsurface, in this area is completely oppositional to the purpose of creating the critical habitat area to protect this region. And I would just add regarding Hillcorp, I listened today, like many of you did, on the spill event with one of their underwater pipelines located 80 feet underground. And near Platform A in the upper inlet, those are waters that are essential habitat to beluga and our upper inlet salmon stocks. And it's certainly any type of spill or discharge that they would immediately disrupt our regional fishing and tourist economy, which is $1 billion annually. And it would cause irreparable harm to the ecology of the bay. I'd add that Kachemak Bay is a vital aspect of the broader ecosystem, which supports all of our commercial fisheries. And it's critical habitat there.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry. We've lost you.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Now, go ahead. Yep. You just cut out about 10 seconds ago.
Okay. I'll just summarize that this critical habitat area was created specifically to protect our region from any type of spill event, and that includes the potential of unforeseeable risks. And so the potential short and long-term impacts, potential impacts of development of oil and gas here in Kachemak Bay is just not worth the risk. And simply oil and gas development is not compatible with our area fisheries. Thank you very much for the time to testify today.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony this morning. I do, again, apologize for mispronouncing your name. Any questions for our testifier? Representative McCabe has a question.
Thank you, sir, and I promptly forgot your name. I'm sorry, but through the chair, I'm interested to know what kind of fishing boat you use when you're out fishing.
Sure. I have a 22-foot Ren Tolman-style skiff that I built myself for set netting, and then I have a slightly larger version of that I use for halibut fishing, and I carry out all of my fisheries here in Kachemak Bay.
Oh, very nice. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I don't see another question. Next, we have Penelope Haas from the Kachemak Bay Conservation Society.
Hello, Chair. My name is Penelope Haas, and I'm calling from Kachemak Bay on behalf of the Kachemak Bay Conservation Society and our members. I really appreciate the testimony given by Josh there, and I hope you'll take that to heart. So I'll just try to speak to a couple other issues. As you know, Kachemak Bay is an area that's very, very rich, and what this bill proposes to do is something a fundamental change to the way that we consider a critical habitat area and the way we consider fisheries protections. Make no mistake, it is about Kachemak Bay, but it's also about the balance between oil and gas and fisheries throughout the entire state of Alaska. Lateral drilling and fracking underground into areas that are closed to oil and gas would change the balance between oil and gas and fisheries protection across the state. And we disagree with the Department of Natural Resources when they say that this presents no risk to fisheries. This presents a substantial risk to fisheries in Kachemak Bay and in the rest of the state of Alaska. It doesn't take long to discover all the risks associated with horizontal drilling and fracking. There's a long list of evidence there around the impacts to underground aquifers and drinking water and water that fish use and need, clean water, in all areas where extensive fracking has occurred. I look forward to sending some of that along to you. I urge you also to ask DNR about the broader implications of this bill, not only as it relates to Kachemak Bay, but as it relates to the rest of the state. This is a precedent-setting change, and we oppose it 100%. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Haas. We appreciate your testimony today. Any questions for our testifier? Okay, no, but sounded like you were going to send some information along. If you send that to my office, we'd be happy to share that with all members. Or, of course, you could send it along yourself as well, but we can share it. Okay, I'm not seeing anyone else online. Is there anyone else signed up for public testimony? Okay, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. We are going to set this bill aside. I knew there'd be, you know, a lot of interest, and sounds like there's a lot people want to learn, you know, getting the information from you folks here at the department. Thank you, Ms. Payne and Mr. Clifton, for the presentation today. So we'll look forward to getting that information from you, and then hopefully you'll have the ability to follow up with members individually and, you know, address any questions. We'll keep in touch with folks about any future hearing. Okay, then that brings us to the end of our business for today. Our next meeting will be on Thursday, April 8th at 10 a.m. We will just have House Concurrent Resolution 2 supporting Alaska Ocean Clusters. That should be a brief meeting because, my friends, on Saturday we will have a long meeting. And so that meeting on Saturday will be confirmation hearings joint with the House Resources Committee. We will be considering the governor's appointee, Fisherman's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council, Marilyn Charles and Renee Weddle Allward, consideration of governor's appointees for the Commercial Fisheries Entries Commission, Melvin Smith, and then consideration of the Board of Fisheries nominees, John Jensen, Mackenzie Mitchell, Marit Carlson Van Dort, Abe Williams, and John Wood. So that we expect could go several hours on Saturday. So we appreciate everyone's participation in that important meeting. Is there anything else to come before committee today? Okay, well, thank you, everyone. If not, then we will go ahead and adjourn at 11:30, and we'll see you on Thursday. Thank you. Have a great day.